Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Jacob Howland. He is McFarland Professor of Philosophy at the University of Tulsa. He is the author of many, many things, many books. I'll just list some of them that will be of interest to our readers. One is Plato and the Talmud. That is from Cambridge University Press from 2011. A book called Kierkegaard and Socrates, A Study in Philosophy and Faith. That's Cambridge University Press, 2006. He's been at Tulsa for 30 years now, made his career there. He studied philosophy at Penn State in the 1980s, still actually a prominent philosophy department. You said in your biography, Jacob, first of all, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
You said you studied with Stanley Rosen, a distinguished philosopher at Penn State. And I didn't know Rosen was a student of Leo Strauss and Alexander Kojève.
That's correct.
Where was Kojève teaching? Was he?
He was in Paris. He was in Paris, and Rosen was over there. I can't remember, maybe on a Fulbright or something like this. But Rosen studied with Kojève, and Kojève famously remarks in a letter that Alan Bloom was there at the same time, and Rosen was very proud that Kojève said, "Rosen's the smarter one."
Well, Bloom, did Bloom translate Kojève's lectures on Hegel? He might have written the introduction to it,
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah, he might have. You're talking about Kojève's brilliant book, Introduction to the Reading of Hegel.
Yes.
I don't believe that Bloom translated that. I'd have to pull it off my shelf. But Kojève had a very strong influence on Stanley Rosen. And incidentally, I was simply saying that Rosen was proud of being mentioned by Kojève in this way. I had the good fortune of knowing Alan Bloom, and I hold him in the highest respect. And so that was not a comment about Alan Bloom. It was more about Stanley Rosen.
Yeah, yeah. And you never know. You know, Kojève might have been trying to tweak Bloom a little bit or something. Who knows?
Sure.
I read Kojève's lectures in graduate school, and they put the hook into me, I've got to say. As they did to, you know, a generation in Europe in the 1930s when he delivered those lectures. But anyway, let's move on to our topic for the day. And usually we talk about books and ideas, but here we're going to talk about an institutional situation, something going on at the University of Tulsa. A distressing trend is happening there. Why don't you tell us what's going on just generally to start?
Sure. Well, I'll just give you the basic facts and then we can dig into it. On April 11th, this is last Thursday, the university administration announced that undergraduate programs in theater, music composition, instrumental and vocal performance, dance, Greek, Latin, and Russian, among others, were eliminated, as were all master's and PhD programs in art, chemistry, history, and physics. Chinese was reduced to a minor. They did not announce that they had destroyed the French and German programs, but in fact, all students in French and German will have to take upper-level courses in study abroad programs. That's going to be prohibitively expensive. It's unclear why they're doing this. We have several excellent professors of French and German literature here, and they won't be allowed to teach students. The reason is that the university thinks the upper-level courses are not sufficiently enrolled. But if I were a language major and I were forced to take all my courses in study abroad programs, you know, that's not the way one learns a language. You need to build up to it. But let me continue here. The majors in philosophy and religion were eliminated. Now, I'm in the Department of Philosophy and Religion. I should say, Mark, that we have a superb department. We are recognized as probably, from a scholarly point of view, the strongest department in the College of Arts and Sciences. For example, one of my colleagues is Russell Hittinger, who is very well known to your audience. He's contributed frequently to First Things. He was on two papal academies. I could go through the list of my other colleagues, but you know, all of us are very high-level publishers. Some of us have won the University Outstanding Teaching Award. Philosophy and religion majors, that is to say the major in philosophy and in religion, were eliminated. We have been reduced to a combined minor of philosophy and religion with the recommendation that our upper level courses for the minor be monitored closely for sufficient enrollment. In addition, there will be no assistantships for graduate students entering, as far as I know, any continuing graduate programs at the University of Tulsa. Arts and Sciences will become a service college. All programs at Arts and Sciences will be combined into four divisions, including one in which the remaining philosophy and religion faculty will serve, called the Division of Humanities and Social Justice.
Social justice.
Correct.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, you know, let me say this.
We'll get to that.
Right, but let me say that even my colleagues in departments, for example, like sociology, who do work that promotes social justice, are upset about this because their response is, we are a theoretical discipline, and whatever we do on the practical side arises from our own theoretical activity. The default course load for all professors at the University of Tulsa had been 3-2. That is, you teach three courses in one semester in an academic year and two in another. It will now be 4-4.
Wow. But that can't be a research university then.
No, and actually, one of the questions that's been raised by students is, what will all of this do to our rankings? And the administration responded by saying, well, we'll remain strong in the rankings. I can tell you, Mark, that, well, let me say, we have traditionally been ranked in the top 100 of major research universities in the United States, right? And at the top, of course, are Harvard and Princeton and places like this. I can assure TU students and alumni and community that we will not fall in those rankings. And the reason is that we will no longer be ranked in that category. We had achieved, I believe the highest ranking we had there was 77 a number of years ago. But a university is required to produce 25 PhDs per year on the average, 20 or 25, I can't remember the precise number. And we will definitely fall far below that threshold because they've eliminated PhD in addition to master's programs across the university. Oh, and I should also say that the existing PhD programs and master's programs will not be allowed to give any assistantship support to incoming students in the fall of 2019, which, as you and I know, means there will be no students in the fall of 2019.
Right. Right. Well, next question. So these are the facts of what is happening. Next question, why is this happening? I mean, what would, if you ask the president, the provost, the leadership, why are you doing this? Maybe first of all, we should say, what would they say is the reason that they are doing this?
Well, that's an excellent question. They have said various things. One thing that they repeat is that the data shows that these cuts are necessary for financial reasons. In the provost's presentation of these cuts last Thursday, we were told that this is a lifeline for the continued existence of the university. They will also say that students have been voting with their feet for a long time because the 40% of programs in the university that are being cut only have 6% of the majors. And incidentally, I forgot to mention one other thing about the facts that needs to be said here. We have an outstanding honors program. It is essentially a great books program. So I've had the great pleasure of teaching in this honors program for 30 years here. Students are told to read the Iliad over the summer. They enter, we read the Odyssey.
That's very good.
We read Herodotus or Thucydides. We read multiple Greek dramas. We read several Platonic dialogues. We read Greek poetry. And then they go on and they study medieval courses. And then they study, they have courses in contemporary, in modern philosophy and modern thought, in contemporary thought and problems of the contemporary world, courses in philosophy of science. Let me say this, our department in philosophy and religion is the mainstay of the honors program in as much as we teach 50% of those courses. But in addition, the greatest part of those courses from taught by faculty outside of our department come from the languages department, the people who are being sidelined. So honors has also been crippled. The provost cut the budget for the honors program in half, and we're hoping we had over 400 applicants for the program this year. It is the highest yielding program in the university. That is to say, the percentage of students who come to the university after being admitted to the honors program is 48%, and that's a very good yield. We will only be able to offer half the number of sections, three sections, this fall because the budget was cut. And yet, the provost says that a, quote, honors-classical studies program, end quote, will continue to exist. So that actually needs to be mentioned. But I should say that this is important because students have been voting with their feet in a very significant way. They have been entering our honors courses. It is a flourishing program. We have something like 265 students in the program right now across the various class levels. So there's this argument about voting with their feet. On the other hand, the university sends contradictory messages. We were also told last Thursday that we are in a very strong financial position. We have a $1.1 billion endowment. An article that I wrote that circulated widely is going to be published in City Journal this afternoon. And in that article, in preparing that article, I was asked by the editors, how can a university with a $1.1 billion endowment be in financial trouble? Good question. But the administrators have repeated the point that the data unambiguously show that we need to make these cuts. I have another piece of data for you. If you look at the audits from the University of Tulsa for the year 2017 to 2018, the revenue for the football, for the athletics programs, fell short of the expenses by $14.7 million. That's some other data. They are not touching in any significant way athletics. So I wonder why that data didn't unambiguously speak to a need to address the drain on the finances of the University of Tulsa imposed by athletics.
So we're seeing what they care about. Forget
That's
the
right.
money. The money is an excuse, and it's a poor excuse because the facts don't line up. These are people who don't give a damn about the humanities. They don't care about liberal education. As part of the decision-making process, were any of the humanities or softer social science people involved in the deliberations?
No. In fact, this is one of the most laughable or tragic aspects of the situation. When the provost was appointed in June, or rather May of 2018, she quickly set about establishing a provost program review committee. And this program review committee was tasked with reviewing all academic programs, and we were told that no academic program could go forward without being reviewed. Now, the review committee, we were told, would evaluate financial data and academic data. Here's how the process worked. Each dean proposed twice as many candidates for the review committee as there were spots. Those candidates were then asked a question, which turned out to be a threshold question. Would you be willing to eliminate programs in your own department? Would you be willing to cut your own programs? Those who answered no were then excluded. Of the remaining group, the provost handpicked the members who eventually ended up on the committee. There was no one from the humanities on the committee. There was no one from the natural sciences on the committee. One could argue there was no one from the liberal arts unless you wanted to claim that a professor of a sort of Paleolithic archaeology or anthropology counts. So the committee proceeded. It was chaired by a professor of accounting. Now,
perfect.
Yes. And they began to assemble data. As is the manner of our administration, they sprung the data on us in a kind of ugly surprise.
Jacob, mm-hmm. This is what you always do. You don't give any advance notice about these things. Did it happen on late Friday afternoon by chance?
Yes, it did. And what happened is the data sheets were given to department chairs. They were instructed to keep them confidential. They were told to reply by the following Monday. What you need to know is that the final grades for the fall semester were due on Tuesday. My department chair received a data sheet, and this is fairly typical. I can give you other examples, but let's just stick with mine. We have 5 members in our department. The data sheet said we had 7 members. The data sheet counted as operating expenses the compensation of Russell Hittinger and myself, 2 endowed chairs. They don't come out of operating expenses. They come out of an endowment. We were later told, well, we're doing this to all departments, so it's, you know, comparing apples to apples. But we have a very high percentage. 40% of our department is endowed chairs. Furthermore, we were not credited with any of the courses. What they were trying to establish is a cost per credit hour, right, for the courses we teach. We were not credited with any of the courses we teach in honors, which is about 50% of our courses. In addition, we were charged for a visiting professor who was paid an $80,000 salary for one semester that came out of an endowment called the Bell Endowment. She was a Bell professor of religion. Now, my chair spent the weekend crafting an outstanding response detailing these errors and handed that in. The following Tuesday, we had a meeting with President Jerry Clancy and Provost Janet Levitt. Janet Levitt received some pushback from the faculty. A professor in English pointed out some of the problems with their data sheets. Levitt then said, I've kept my distance from the PPRC, the committee, so I actually haven't seen the data. But I can guarantee that it is accurate to within 2%, and I intend to release the data by Friday. This was a Tuesday, to make it public. And in fact, the PPRC ultimately was forced to admit to us that they had overstated our costs by 40%. The provost ended that meeting, as is also typical of this administration, with an implicit threat. She said something that Jerry Clancy, the president, had said in emails and that she has said on more than one occasion. If you can suspend disbelief and if you are committed to working with us toward our future plans, then there will be a place for you at this university.
Okay.
Now, I have to tell you, Mark, it is no longer possible for us to suspend disbelief. What they have done exceeds belief. It is literally incredible.
You know, the question is, I mean, let's get past the high-handedness here. What are the faculty going to do? Because the administrators, they're just pressing forward, and they probably have allies among all the units and the instructors in areas of the campus that are going to do well on this plan.
They do, in fact, have allies. I expected, but was nonetheless disappointed, to hear a fair number of people applauding when the plan was rolled out in a very large meeting last Thursday. I can tell you what has happened since that meeting on Thursday. I had prepared a piece. I'd been writing it for many months because I saw the writing on the wall about what was happening at the university. Late Thursday evening, I decided to send an email to about 50 faculty members and about 495 students, all in the honors program, many of whom had already graduated, telling them that if possible, they should come to a meeting at the Department of Languages, which was going to have their own internal meeting at noon. And I thought it'd be good if some people came. And I forwarded the article that I mentioned. When I showed up at Oliphant Hall for the 12 o'clock meeting on Friday, there were 400 people present. We then moved into a theater. In this theater, students got up and spoke from a broad range of disciplines. I would say we asked the students in engineering and natural sciences, which were basically unscathed, to raise their hand, and something like 75, maybe 50, 75 students were there. Some of those spoke about how important it was for them to be involved in theater and music and things like this, and philosophy and religion. At that meeting, we organized. A Facebook group was formed, and Mark, I'm not on Facebook. I had never intended to be, but sometimes, like Churchill, you have to join one devil in order to fight another. I joined the group. The group has 1.2 thousand members, and this group has been a focus, central point of organization. And these students have already engaged in several protests. They have engaged in a peaceful sit-in at the main administrative building. They have conducted poetry readings, protest readings, and so forth. They have planned a large funeral for the liberal arts to be held on Friday. They have spoken to the local news stations, three or four stations, who are not allowed to come on campus, by the way, because they have not been invited by the administration. In addition, we have been reaching out to people who have an affiliation with the school or a special connection with Tulsa.
I would think all the alumni who graduated from these kinds of programs, they've got to be on board.
Yes. And a petition was started. Students crafted a petition. I and other professors worked with them. That petition is on a website called change.org.
And good old change.org, yes.
I would urge your listeners who are interested in helping us to sign that petition. If you go to change.org and type in University of Tulsa, it will come up. It's something called like the soul of the University of Tulsa. We have approximately 3,000 signatures now. But also the faculty have been collectively acting. The School of Law, to its great credit, which lost only a few programs, but some very important ones, by the way, like Indian Law, which is one of their specialties, voted on Monday that they would not implement key elements of the restructuring, such as the 4-4 course load in the coming year. And they demanded that their faculty, selected by their faculty, a group of their faculty, review the consequences for the university and the college of the restructuring. The student assembly met last night into the early hours of this morning, and they passed a resolution stating no confidence in the restructuring. The College of Arts and Sciences is going to meet tonight at 6 p.m., and we are going to pass our own resolution rejecting the restructuring in the next year, and demanding that a hand-selected group of our own faculty review the entire thing. I should say the university has been responding as expected. We get emails saying we are committed to free expression and so forth, but be aware that any meeting that does not have the approval of the administration can be immediately disbanded. That's to
be
expected.
Let's see them disband the faculty, the meeting of the professors, well, with 20 people having their cell phones recording everything. This is where we are now. You really want to keep professor? You really want to try to stop a discussion on campus among 45 professors? Wow.
Right. And I have to say, Mark, I think it's extremely unlikely for the reason that you mentioned that would occur. But they're on their back heels. I'm doing this podcast with you, which I'm greatly appreciative of, and all my colleagues and students are. Tomorrow I will be giving an interview to the local radio station that's run by the college, and we have an excellent interviewer. And I think that's going to be very meaningful because I'm going to speak to Tulsans about what is happening. The local paper, the Tulsa World, has so far been quite pathetic. They actually wrote an editorial saying, you know, some students and faculty are grumbling, but this is necessary and good and wonderful. In addition, we've been reaching out to alumni or to people who are concerned, as I said. So, for example, the actor Tim Blake Nelson, whose play Socrates is opening on Broadway today.
Wow.
And I mentioned that because I gave notes to him. So that's how I know him. He read my piece. It had circulated to him, and he said, "What can I do?" And I suggested he write an op-ed for the Tulsa World, which he did. A very beautiful piece. And the Tulsa World may actually publish it because it comes from a very well-known Hollywood actor. So we'll see. And of course, the fact that you, Mark, are having me on the First Things podcast, and that I've had just tremendous support. Wilfred McClay at the University of Oklahoma has been terrific. George Leaf at the Martin Center. The National Association of Scholars is getting involved. I think
Jacob, the issue here is, in a situation like this, it's not just about Tulsa. Because what happens at Tulsa will be taken by administrators and professors at many other schools as a lesson. This is what can happen, and this is what professors have to do if they want to sustain academic norms. If this all goes through, then it will embolden the bean counters, those who want to rationalize all of higher education by the dollar, or even when you have some of the financial data on your side, it keeps the anti-intellectuals from pushing the university toward this, as your strategic plan puts it, this sort of hyper-rationalized zone of, quote, innovation, strategic thinking, problem solving, the jobs of the future. I read the strategic plan that you sent to me, and the language is there. It's partly just bureaucracies, and by the way, there are many, many grammatical and syntactical and punctuation errors scattered throughout that document, by the way. But it's the language we've heard all before about the future and the 21st century and preparing students to enter the world capable of doing the jobs of the digital age and so on. Nothing in that strategic plan shows the slightest ounce of respect for Plato or for Shakespeare or for Mozart, any of the other values of culture and citizenship. That's missing. It is a total rationalized document that Jonathan Swift would have a good time with.
I agree. And I have to tell you something, that when the PPRC, the Program Review Committee, met, they were assigned to read a short book by a man named W.F. Massey, published in 2016, called Re-Engineering the University, How to Be Mission-Centered, Market Small, and Margin Conscious. And let me give you just a quotation from them, from the book. Some years ago, I became convinced that the main problems of traditional universities do not stem from lack of intention. Most universities want to do better, but a large portion of these efforts have been overwhelmed by other priorities. Complacency and self-interest play a role, of course, but the root problem is a deeply held commitment to traditional values and concepts.
Ooh, we got to get rid of those, Jacob.
Right.
Traditional values and concepts, they're sticking points. They're a problem.
Right. And, you know, of course, the university, it's been around for 1,000 years as an institution, and its fundamental task is the preservation, cultivation, and transmission of knowledge. The new administration does not ask in its strategic plan what we want our students to learn. Rather, it asks, quote, how do we want TU students to feel, end quote. And the answer consists in the four pillars of the new TU commitment: accepted, physically, emotionally, and spiritually safe; engaged, not talked down to, you have a voice and a desire to be heard; empowered, and launched on a voyage of self-discovery. Now, our president is an MD. He's a psychiatrist. He really doesn't have an academic background to speak of, although he has taught at the University of Oklahoma and the University of Iowa. But he's very sort of touchy-feely. His plans are informed by outside consultants who have a kind of cold vision of a university as career preparation,
right,
bottom
right,
line,
right,
and so forth.
Here's what I would suggest, Jacob. I bet that the University of Tulsa participates in the National Survey of Student Engagement, NSSE, NESE.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. If you could get from the administration the numbers, I mean, I've used numbers at Emory before to mark up, okay, what do incoming students want? What do they care about? If you could get those recent survey figures and look at the questions from students about what they want out of their undergraduate education. You might look up how many of them want to be liberal arts majors, history, English, theater, and so on. You would also look about at the attitudes questions. One of the attitudes questions says, what do you expect out of this education? And then you've got some questions about money, good job, but there are also possible answers of to form a meaningful philosophy of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
if you can show, look, we've got 40%, 30 to 40% of incoming students who care about the humanistic disciplines. They think about a meaningful philosophy of life just as much as they think about jobs and careers. That could be one, that could be a strong data point in your favor, that what you are doing here is leaving a significant number of Tulsa undergraduates out in the cold.
Now, I think that's an excellent suggestion, and I have to tell you that
if they'll give it to you, knowing that you are you're on the barricades now.
Right, and I should say, by the way, they're very unforthcoming with information. They have billed the process as transparent, inclusive, and data-driven, and in fact, it's been none of these things. But I can tell you some interesting things about the data. If you look at the audited report for 2017 to 2018, we read that teaching and research, that is to say academics, cost $91 million at our university in that academic year. Everything else is $113 million, and they don't actually in that total breakout, you know, specific costs in the administration and so forth. The administration is growing and growing because they're hiring. They have now a new proposal for a surrounding incoming students with a number of advisors and mentors, health and financial well-being advisors, success coaches, peer and alumni mentors, career and professional development coaches. And these will presumably be outsiders who've been hired by the administration. Students have made it very clear that they don't want that.
They want their teachers.
Right. They want their teachers. I've received 100 emails from outside the school since these events began to occur, and a large number of them are from students who have written me with anguish and sorrow and the most heartfelt expressions of the importance of liberal education and in particular the honors program on their lives. I have I taught a fellow named Luke Lehman. He was a kid in my honors freshman course years ago. And he writes me, he says, I'm in third year medical school. He says, I use my engineering courses once a week in my job. I use my language courses once a week. I use my honors courses every single day. And of course, that's the case because, look, in our society in general, we're moving toward this corporate model, cookie cutter, kind of heartless, soulless training, et cetera. And at the same time, predictably enough, we have a really serious deficit of meaning in the individual lives of human beings. And incidentally, I have to tell you that, you know, many students have been very upset with these cuts, and they just got an email today or yesterday saying, from the administration saying, you know, we're aware that a lot of you are upset, and so we would like to offer you non-confidential counseling sessions to help you with your distress. Notice, by the way, this is the sort of therapeutic cure. They're not actually addressing the root problems as to why any students might be upset.
Right, right. I mean, they're upset over a change taking place. This isn't a pathology
that right.
has to be worked through in therapy. But first of all, this doesn't take their responses seriously, and it infantilizes them. So we're gonna take care of this for you anyway. Jay, we've actually run over time. But is there any final thing you want to say to people who want to find out more about the situation? You said you've got an article coming out in City Journal.
City Journal. It's going to be online. We've got this podcast. You know, people are welcome to contact me and by email. I should say that my email was blocked and shut down this morning for a couple of hours. It's back up. But the safest route is probably to contact me at jacob.howland@gmail.com. And I'm happy to give people updates. Go to change.org and sign the petition. We have a lot of allies. Paul Ray, my wonderful colleague, gave an interview or a podcast with Andrew Klavan, and he discussed the situation at the school. So hunt that down. You'll be hearing a lot more about this on the national level.
Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks a lot, Mark.